From the Drift Cafe, I'm Rick Moore, along with Heather Atwood of The Other Cape. And you've had many different iterations here.
I have. The Mid-Pod, The Other Cape, Food for Thought.
Yeah,
I know.
Speaking about Food for Thought, before we get into today's topics, your cookbook is still available. And remind me about the cookbook and what it is, what the name of it is, and what the recipes are and that and so on.
Okay, but here's the thing. My cookbook is not available.
Really?
It is out of print already, which is kind of sad.
Yeah.
I think there's some, in the publishing world, these things come and go.
Okay.
I mean, you can buy it on Amazon. It's super expensive.
Really?
Yeah, it's like $70.
It's worth it. It's worth it. It's worth it.
Right? Right. Yeah. So, and I have no copies. Yeah. I have my two tattered copies. That's all I have. But, you know, supposedly I can get the licensing and republish it, but I might do that. I don't know.
Okay. Well, I know that you're working on other things.
Yes.
So why don't we get to that? What's the first topic today?
Okay. So I do have an announcement that I am coming back as a food writer, as a local food writer. I'm going to have a blog on the website that I currently am the managing editor for, The Other Cape, theothercape.com. And we are going to have a food blog there.
Good.
My food blog. We don't have a name for it yet, but it's going to be some of Heather's thinking, but mostly it's going to be me traveling around to Cape Ann and the North Shore, interviewing local people and getting recipes from local people.
There is a tremendous richness of cuisine, of recipes, of culture, of I don't know how to describe what umbrella it comes under, but on Cape Ann, on the North Shore, if you spread out a little bit further, there is just so many different aspects of food.
There are, and I just never get tired of meeting people and learning about their food cultures or learning about their food habits. And I have to tell you what our launch recipe, or not our launch recipe, our launch profile for this blog is, because I think it is absolutely perfect. I have interviewed Inga McCarthy, who is the owner of Cake Ann.
Cake Ann, yeah.
Cake Ann,
yeah.
Which is an amazing bakery. If you haven't been there, it's at the end edge of Gloucester, just before you get into Rockport, just above the Common Crow in that little mall there. And Inga is such a talented baker. Her cakes and her cupcakes are incredible, but she's also told me she's doing a lot more savory things, too. So,
well, what does that mean, savory things?
To have for dinner. So you can get dinner and dessert.
Oh.
Now, like a galette, which is a little tart that has local squash and goat cheese in it. Rick has now we've lost him. Okay, I'm going to try to get him back. Meat pie. She makes meat pies with Truppiano's turkey sausage.
Okay?
So do you know about Truppiano's sausage, right? You don't?
No.
Do you eat sausage?
No.
Oh, you don't. I still can't figure you out, but that's all right. Anyway, Inga at Cake Ann is also doing some savory things. I will write about that in the blog.
Excellent.
But I asked her, the queen of the Bûche de Noël and the queen of, your listeners will know this, you won't, a pastry called Queen Amon. Super, super delicious pastry. I'm going to bring you one. You would love that.
Okay.
So Inga is the queen of those things. She's an incredible baker, and she has spent all of November and December baking her heart out. So I asked her, well, Inga, what do you do in January? You must still have to make your family dinner. And do you have this sense of resolution? Do you have this sense of needing to eat healthy? And she gave me this beautiful recipe that you will see on the blog. And she said, yes, I do. And you want something warm. You want something healthy. You might not call it diet, but you want it to feel like it's good for you. So that's how we're going to open up.
Okay, good. And when is that going to be?
That will probably drop next week, at the end of the week.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So you've got some research done already.
I have the recipe. I have to make the recipe and take some pictures. That's really my goal. So I will be making that recipe. I'm going to leave it a secret this afternoon.
And did you interview her, like, you know, the usual story behind the recipe?
I did, yes. But these are going to be short blogs, so it's not like a real in-depth interview. But I am going to do that for The Other Cape. In about a month, I'm going to do a long-form interview with Inga, and that won't drop until probably April.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the comfort food. This weekend, of course, with the football playoffs and the Patriots, my wife asked me what we should have, and I'm the same with the cold weather coming in January, and my thing was chicken soup. That's what I want. So.
Well, you know what? now I have to let the cat out of the bag. That's what Inga's recipe is.
Oh, no
but
way.
It's actually, you know, her version of chicken
course,
soup.
Of
yeah,
exactly.
Oh,
that's cool.
Yeah. No, that's all I want right now, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
Honestly, that's all
yeah,
I want.
Yeah.
And noodles and that really good broth. Yep.
I have a great recollection of skiing a few years ago, and it was 25 below zero, and we went skiing, my buddy and I, and we had two families in a condo, and when we came back about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it's dark, and the families were there, and we had chicken soup waiting for us before the football game, and it's just a great memory. So it's real comfort food in this weather for me.
It really is comfort food, isn't it? I
yeah.
know. It's actually, in my family, we used to have chicken soup Mondays. Every
oh, okay.
Monday
mm-hmm.
was chicken, but I made all different kinds of chicken soup. I made Thai chicken soup. I made.
Of course you did.
Yes. So it was. It would be a surprise, but we always had chicken soup. And it was kind of good because the kids go to school. Monday's kind of a crummy day for everybody, mm-hmm. and we always knew Monday
nice.
Night was chicken soup.
Okay, so I got a point on that one. Boy, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's
all right.
Pretty good agreement.
Well, I'm glad that you're doing that again because I've kind of missed that. Now, you mentioned in our pregame warm-up here, you've got a bunch of scallops in your car.
I have 10 pounds of the most beautiful scallops a person has ever seen in the back of my car, in a cooler in the back of my car. I am going to deliver them to some special people who have they were in on the deal. So there's another 5-pound bag in my refrigerator. So I have a friend who knows Mike Anderson, who is the captain of the Rimrack, which is a day boat out of Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And the Rimrack has been tooting around Ipswich Bay fishing for scallops in the past couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of fun to have, you know, be able to buy fish still right off the boat,
course,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And these scallops are so beautiful. And I was saying in our pregame thing, for the past couple of years, I've gotten these scallops from the Rimrack, and you know, I go to my friend and I write her a check and she gives me the bags, you know, and sometimes we meet in a parking lot. But I don't know why this is such a great time of year for scallops.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually called Red's Best this morning and I asked them, I said, so there are all these amazing sea scallops in Massachusetts right now. What's going on? And she said, you know, I don't really know. So she said, yeah, the boats are going out. This is a season in Massachusetts or the New England coast for scallops. They're doing local scallops, and the day boats are going. So, you know, that when I say day boat, that means they go in and out
right.
in one day.
Right.
Now, in New Bedford, it's a whole different story. New Bedford is actually the number one ranked fishing port in the country for fish landings, and it's all scallops. 80% of what they bring in is scallops, and that is, I think it's like a $800 million industry. And those boats go out for 12 and 15 days, and they go down to the Mid-Atlantic and all that. So this is a different thing. These are scallops that, you know, one boat is going out and coming back in the same day, and they're finding the scallops right off the Massachusetts coast, and they're big and plump. Apparently the cold water makes them plump, too.
Okay.
So they're delicious, and I'm excited about that.
Okay, that sounds it sounds amazing. And now finally switching gears, we're back to our top 50 best foods or most popular in the country?
We are at, I have to find my little notes here, 26 and 25, is that right?
Yep.
Yes. Okay, so 26. You know, I have to pause here and say, this has not been the most exciting list for me.
Okay.
What I have learned in this 50 best American, favorite American foods is that it gets a little dull. Okay.
Gets
this
a little what?
Dull.
Okay.
As a food writer, it can be a little. I know, and it's your favorite list.
It sounds normal to me, but you call it dull. Okay.
Okay. All right. Number 26 is a peanut butter sandwich. Okay.
That upsets you.
Right? It does. Okay. So, but I learned a little bit about peanut butter. There was a patent, the first patent on making peanut butter happened actually in 1884,
wow.
not in this country, but in Montreal.
Mm.
Okay, so I don't know where he got the peanuts, because do they grow them in Montreal? I don't know. But this guy, Marcellus Edson, came up with a patent for peanut butter. And in 1898, that seems to be when peanut butter really took off in this country, Mr. Kellogg, John Harvey Kellogg,
oh, okay.
right?
Yeah.
He was really into good health, which is why he created all these cereals.
Mm-hmm.
And he had these very expensive healthcare institutes, Mr. Kellogg. And he was creating all these diets for his healthcare institutes. And peanut butter was something that he was serving in his institutes. And it was consequently something for the very wealthy.
Wow.
Peanut butter was
How about that?
Right? It was spa cuisine back then. And then in 1902, the company, you may know this company, Peter Pan Peanut Butter.
Oh, sure, of course.
That came around in 1902, and that seemed to be created by people who worked for Kellogg. And in 1922, a guy named Rosefield figured out how to hydrogenize peanut butter so that it was smooth and creamy. And he came up with a company, you might have heard of it, Skippy.
Skippy, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And then he added chunks back in, and he created creamy versus chunky.
Sure.
So Skippy had that. And then in the 1950s, Procter & Gamble added sweetener, and it became sweet, and they created a company called Jif.
Okay.
So Peter Pan, Skippy, and Jif.
And it's, I'm sure it's a big billion-dollar industry.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, you know. I'm sure.
No, I think that's cool, and it's the nutritional value of peanut butter is well documented. I think someday I'm going to research what happened to peanut allergies when they because they're so they're just everywhere now.
Yeah, yeah. That is one of the bigger mysteries.
Yeah,
it's and I don't think even allergists understand it. It's really bizarre.
Ubiquitous was the word I was looking for, but I couldn't.
Pervasive, invasive. Yeah, all those.
I like the green crabs. okay, so 26. See, that makes sense to me. Peanut butter, very popular. All right, so let's go to 25.
Okay, 20.
And great stories. Thank you.
Oh, you're quite welcome. 25, baked beans. Dead silence here. right? I feel the same way. We might agree.
Yeah, I'll go with boring on that one.
Totally boring, okay? Yeah. And the stories are pretty good. Beans themselves are native to Central and South America. And thousands of years ago, they crept up into our Native American population. So our indigenous people definitely grew beans. There's a little bit of a gray area about baked beans. Of course, we know about the Three Sisters. You know how the Native Americans grew corn, beans, and squash together, and that way of cultivating was called the Three Sisters. Do you know about that? No. You're looking at me with a really funny face.
No, I had never heard of that. Honestly.
You've never heard that?
No, I hadn't.
Yeah, and the corn stalks were structure for the beans to climb up.
Wow, okay.
And the squash leaves made shade and kept weeds away.
Wow.
And so that was they would grow in these mounds. So each mound would have one of each plant. So beans were a Native American thing. And they believe that the Penobscot Indians in Maine were already burying beans, cooking beans by burying pots in the ground the way that we hear the lumber people did, right? But that being said, they also believe that beans went to Europe around 1598, okay? They left the New World for the Old World around 1598. And there are people who believe beans came back as baked beans in the form of cassoulet, which is this classic French dish.
Now you're getting excited.
Actually, that does excite me a little bit more because there's usually venison and duck in cassoulet and it has a crusty, breadcrumbs on top. And that's really delicious. So whether baked beans are a product of the Penobscot Indians putting them in the ground the way people do, or whether it was an idea that came from the French into hunting lodges and things.
Is there a nutritional value in beans?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a protein that it's a form of protein. And it's a, what do they call it? So you can eat, you don't need another source to make a complete protein. It's a complete protein.
All right.
Yeah.
And any idea where the Boston baked bean came from?
I don't.
It's pretty popular, or at least well-known.
Yeah, I think it's a brand. But so baked beans...
Marketing, probably, then.
Yes, was one of the first canned goods.
Oh, okay.
And, I didn't look into the Boston part, but I shouldn't even say that, because I'm not quite sure.
No, that's fine. That's fine. Just good information, and I learned a lot. Peanut butter and beans, 26 and 25. Very interesting. Okay, so we look forward to, and what's out there right now on the other Cape?
Right now, dropping, I think, today is quite a beautiful story about our local hero, Greg Gibson. Do you know about Greg Gibson? Greg Gibson is a rare book dealer. He lives in Lanesville. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, his son, Galen Gibson, was one of the very first victims of gun violence. His son, I think in the early 90s, his son was a student at Simon's Rock College, and another very disturbed student had an AR-15 and killed Galen at randomly and a professor.
Oh, my.
So Greg Gibson has ever since then been a really outspoken, voice in the gun violence discussion. And he wrote a book called Gone Boy, which really examines, actually, not his son, but the boy who murdered him. This is more of the story, yeah.
And that's on the other cape now?
Yeah, yeah. I think it's today. It drops beautiful photographs by Jason Groh. And Greg has continued to do that work, as you can imagine.
Wow.
You know, he calls it the club that you don't want to join for the parents who are suffering or families who have endured this also.
Exactly. Well, on that note, we'll end it. We look forward to seeing you again in a few weeks from the Drift Cafe.
Or maybe elsewhere, because we think the Drift is closing.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, we'll be back from somewhere. This is MSONewsSports.com.